Okay, I'm going to call the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee to order. I'm going to have Ms. Hansen take the roll, and then we'll go to approving the minutes. Ms. Hansen?
Perfect. Good morning. I'm still letting a couple of members in. 1 second. Okay. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner? Lead Albright? I see him on the screen. Representative Bolden? Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Thank you. Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Hansen, present.
Thank you. Representative Keel?
Present.
Representative Liebling?
Liebling, present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Moore? He's here, I know he is. Representative Novotny?
Present.
Representative Pearson?
Pearson, present.
Thank you. Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Sandell? Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Thank you. And Vice Chair Bonner, I see you there. As well as Representative Sandell just arrived. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. So we have a quorum. Representative Albright, would you like to move the minutes from February 3rd? We're having trouble hearing you, Representative Albright. Representative Bonner, would you like to move the minutes?
I did to move the minutes. These are from yesterday, correct?
February 3rd.
February 3rd. I will move the minutes from February 3rd of 2022.
Okay, Vice Chair Bonner moves the minutes from February 3rd. Are there any corrections or additions to those minutes? If not, please unmute yourself for voice vote. All those in favor to approve the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, minutes are approved. Okay, members, so we met last Thursday and we went over, we had a lot of very powerful testimony and we went through a waiver bill. And just an update, Representative Robbins and I are working on an amendment to address the foster care televideos visits, and we're working on that and we'll bring an amendment to the next committee stop, which is Chair Liebling's Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today we have with us our state demographer, Susan Brower, and she's going to give us an overview of Minnesota's aging population and our disability community. And then we'll take a few questions, if you have any, from our state demographer. And then we're going to move on to a presentation by the Department of Human Services on deep poverty. And then we have a few testifiers, so we should have time for questions after that presentation as well. So I'm going to welcome our state demographer, Susan Brower, here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony and presentation. And thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Good morning, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Susan Brower. I'm the state demographer and I work in the Department of Administration. Let me share my screen with you. I'll say while I'm doing that I was asked today to speak about where we are with respect to our aging trend. We all are well aware that we're aging, but I hope to give you more definition around the timing and the scope of that trend, give some information on disability communities in Minnesota. And then finally, I'll share where we are with respect to how our aging is related to our workforce growth and how that's impacting the care of provision of services and what we can expect in the future based on our demographics. So to begin, here's our aging trend in the state of Minnesota. You can see that the rapid increase begins in 2010 and carries through to about 2020, where we go from about 685,000 older adults, adults who are age 65 plus, to about 1.2 million, and we do that in the period of about 20 years. We're about halfway through that transition period. So what's moving this trend forward, of course, is the baby boomers who were born between 1946 and 1964. They've begun to transition into this age group. We're about halfway there. We'll continue to transition into this age group over the next 10 years. We're very, very close to having about 1 million older adults in the state. We don't have our detailed age data back from the 2020 census yet, so I can't say with certainty, but we're right around that year where we will hit that milestone of having 1 million older adults in the state of Minnesota for the first time. And if we look at even the older ages, people who are 75 plus, that trend is very similar, but you can see kind of just to give you a visual of what we're talking about when we're talking about increased need for long-term services and support, for healthcare services, higher rates of disability, all these things follow really when we're talking about the much older ages, 75 and above. We will see between now and about 2030, an additional about 300,000 older adults in this age group, in the 75 plus age group. And that's where we will see, in particular, that additional demand for services related to aging in the older years. Just to give a sense of where our older adults are living across the state, the size of these bubbles represents the older adult population in each county. It really follows the distribution of people generally. That's not surprising, but you can see that the majority of older adults, like the concentration of people in the Twin Cities areas, this really follows that geographic distribution. Our larger counties that have larger populations, we see larger populations of older adults there as well. And I just share this with you because oftentimes we have the sense that aging is impacting rural communities more. And in fact, I'll talk about that in a minute. That's absolutely the case, but we see larger numbers of people just following the population distribution of the state generally, of older adults in our metropolitan areas. This greater Minnesota line that I'm showing you in the table here, the 313,000, those are people in greater Minnesota that are outside of our major metropolitan statistical areas not shown on the table. So that's not the sum total of everyone outside the seven county metro. That is just the number of folks who are outside those major metropolitan areas, which hold the most people in the state. If we look at the concentration or the percent of people in each county who are over the age of 65, that's where we really see those darker counties representing higher concentrations of older adults in those counties. And that's where you can start to really get the sense of the areas that have already been impacted by this aging trend and that are experiencing the aging trend in some ways much more acutely and earlier than the rest of the state. If we were to look at a map of rural versus urban Minnesota, it would look very similar with respect to the color variation because those rural areas of the state are the areas that have the highest percentage of older adults, even though it's not the highest number, and have a lower percentage of younger working age residents, which will pose problems and is already posing problems in many cases in terms of the provision of care. I'll talk about that more kind of at the end here. But I want to talk a little bit more about our older adult population and just what they look like with respect to the composition of that group. And in Minnesota, our older adult population is still primarily almost completely homogeneous white non-Hispanic. 94% of Minnesota's older adults are white, non-Hispanic. As you can see here, that the majority of our racial and ethnic diversity in the state is in the younger ages. And that's fairly different from what we see nationally, where 77% of older adults are part of a are white non-Hispanic. So we're much less diverse with respect to our older population than the nation is as a whole.
Ms. Brower, I think Representative Albright may have a question on the last slide. Representative Albright?
Madam Chair, can you hear me now?
We can.
Thank you. Ms. Brower, yes, thank you. To that slide, and I'm looking at some of the counties, you know, Aiken, Lake, and some of those, and obviously some of those counties are very attractive for retirement because of the lakes and the retirement communities around cabins and making retirement homes there. To what extent is the migration to some of these counties done so because of people retiring away from the metro to where they want to age in place, make a new home for themselves? What inference can you draw from that observation?
Ms. Brower?
Chair Schultz, Representative. I'd say we have seen growth more so in the kind of central area that I'm talking about here, this kind of lakes region, more so than the kind of northeast of the state, that really likely is driven by migration after retirement. But by and large, I think what is producing these differences really is just kind of the longer term migration trends playing out, where we see movement of the younger generation away from some of the more rural parts of the state. And that has happened over decades. So what we're seeing is this higher percentage of older adults who have stayed there in place with a relatively smaller set of working age and younger folks. So to the extent that migration to the lake or to the lakes region of the state is playing a role, yes, we do see some of that, but I think probably the majority, from what I know about the kind of the number of people who stay in place in any given year is much greater than the number of people who move. That's really what's producing these differences.
Representative Albright?
No, thank you. Thank you. That was very helpful.
Please proceed, Ms. Brower.
Thank you, Chair. So as I said, very homogenous, very much a white, non-Hispanic group of older adults. We'll see that become more diverse moving forward. In part, what has happened here over time is that Minnesota really became much more racially diverse beginning in the 1990s. That's where our growth in diversity really took off. And that was driven by increases in international immigration. People tend to migrate when they're younger. So some of that diversity that we saw beginning in the 1990s, those folks haven't reached these older ages yet. Another more sobering trend that is impacting this difference in diversity, of course, is differences in life expectancy for populations of color relative to white non-Hispanic. And so that may be playing a part, likely is playing a part here too, why we see such a largely white non-Hispanic population in our older ages. But this is who our older adults are today. And we can see kind of specifically the groups that are represented among BIPOC older adults when we're talking about the provision of services and talking about those who may be in need of services and supports, we'll see a higher concentration of people of color in the older age groups as well because of the economic disparities that we see a lot across the life course. So just to give you a sense of the whole of older adults, very much a white non-Hispanic group, but we may see more people of color requiring services at those ages just because of other social and economic disparities. And the poverty rate, it's just one measure of economic stability or resources available to folks. It is relatively low for older adults compared to other age groups. As you can see here, it's below the state average for the poverty rate, which is at 9% now. So for those who are in their mid-60s to early 70s, that poverty rate is about 7%, just a bit higher for those 75 plus. Of course, the poverty line is very, very low, as you can see here, for older adults living alone. Excuse me. The poverty threshold is $12,000, which, of course, we all know is a very, very low threshold. I think you'll be talking about deep poverty later on, so I don't want to downplay this proportion of group who are in poverty, but just give you the context of other poverty groups in other ages in Minnesota. Of course, the other difference is that those who are in poverty in their older ages are much more likely to stay in poverty because they're not moving in and out of the workplace. They don't necessarily have other life events that are changing their income, although that could be the case with the death of a partner or a spouse. But those who are in poverty are much more likely to stay in poverty at those older ages. I'd like to move on now to speak a little bit about the disability community. I'm happy to take questions as we go, Chair Schultz, or to take them at the end. It's up to you. But
Representative Albright probably has a question on the last slide. And I'll just note that also on that last slide, it's really interesting, the 18 to 24-year-olds, how high that poverty rate is. But also, I think that's the largest group for out-migration of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Chair Schultz, yes. So that rate, 18 to 24, think college students, think people who are just starting out their careers. They have lower incomes because they're not working, because many of them are in school, and so their incomes are just not the same.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was my observation as well, as I think that bar for the 18 to 24-year-old bracketing really, you know, the context around that with regard to, and Ms. Brower was going to see whether or not you had any back story on that in terms of whether that group is the group that would claim themselves as not being dependent upon a family, that they are on their own, you know, in terms of from a tax filing perspective, if they're filing singly, or is it muddled a little bit by just income only, where you're, you know, in college or just, you know, going through graduate school, that type of thing, where you've got low income, but you're working on your career path, but being supported by your family for whatever purposes that is defined as.
Ms. Brower?
Chair Schultz, Representative, yes, it's the latter, absolutely. So these numbers come from a survey which asks what your income was in the last year, and it's income from all sources, whether it's income from parents, income from working alone, but we know that college students are making that investment. People this age are making that investment that are like it's likely to pay off later in their career. So they're many are foregoing the income at those ages to make more later on.
Thank you, Ms. Brower. I don't see any more questions from members, so just continue and then we'll take questions at the end.
All right. Thank you, Chair Schultz. So I'll share some numbers on disability within the state of Minnesota, populations with disabilities, and this is the definition that I will be using. There are many other definitions, but for today, this comes from a survey that reaches the whole state, and so it really helps us get our arms around the extent of disability without going through administrative records of people who have accessed different systems of support. So this comes from the Census Bureau's American Community Survey, which is an ongoing survey. And it asks questions about these six different types of difficulties that you see here. The first four being kind of areas of basic functioning: hearing difficulty, vision difficulty, cognitive and ambulatory difficulty. So all of these may be, you know, present at birth. They may have to do with a chronic illness or some other kind of disease, or it may be brought on by aging, and we'll see what that looks like by age in a moment. The other two types of questions, self-care and independent living, relate to activities of daily living, whether the person responding to the survey has difficulty bathing or dressing, or whether they have difficulty with basic kind of tasks of independent living, like errands, visiting a doctor's office, that kind of thing. So this is the definition of disability that I'm using, and I just want to acknowledge that there are many different ways to measure disability. This does have some drawbacks, but you know, it is one of the strengths is that we are able to look at all Minnesotans and see what the rates of disability across these types of different functions and activities of daily living look like. And so with that, using this definition, we find that about 600,000 Minnesotans have a disability. It's about 11% of the population. And what's really stands out to anyone looking at this slide is just the increase over time, and particularly the increase after age 74, after age 64 and then age 74, that you see those numbers double and then quadruple after those ages. And if we look at the specific types of disability that I just described to you by age group, you can see in each of these sets, the lowest bar here represents children under the age of 18, the dark blue here, then young adults, 18 to 34, older adults, 35 to 64, and then older adults, 65 to 74 and 75 plus. So we're looking both at how these disabilities kind of progress over the life course, and then across these disabilities, looking at how prevalent they are. In the younger ages, before people reach about age 65, cognitive disabilities really stand out in terms of the largest prevalence of disability, according to this definition. So you can see a much higher proportion of people with cognitive disabilities at the younger ages relative to hearing or vision or ambulatory, for example. And then to me, what stands out is ambulatory difficulties beginning in later adulthood, 35 to 64, we see this jump. But of course, the overwhelming thing that stands out on this graph is just the increase in disability across all types, beginning at about age 65.
Looks like Representative Robbins has a question. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, thank you, Ms. Brower. I was also struck by that there's no number for 18 and under for independent living. And I know there are younger Minnesotans who maybe it's just because definitionally under 18, they can't live independently. But I'd like to understand that, because there are people who are severely disabled who are younger Minnesotans. So could you address that, please?
Dr. Brower?
Representative Chair Schultz, Representative. Yes, thank you for pointing that out. I should have pointed that out. That is indeed a definitional thing. That question is not asked of related to children. And so by definition, no one could be in that group. Assuming that those types of independent living activities that are captured by that group of things is, you know, shopping, going to the doctor, absolutely, you know, that could be done by older teens, I suppose. But in general, that's a question that's not asked of that age group. But absolutely, that there are disabilities that are impact function enough that would be the case. Just as soon as those folks hit 18, they would be included in that measure.
Thank you.
Please continue, Dr. Brower.
Chair Schultz, thank you. I don't have anything to say particularly here. I just wanted you to have the numbers of the different types of disability by age. So there they are. I will say that if we look across the state in terms of disability, it does mirror in many ways the aging trend that we saw. And I think that's pretty self-explanatory after we saw just how much disability increases with age at the older ages, that we're going to see higher rates of disability in areas that are more rural, in areas that have older adult populations. There, you know, you can see much less disability in some of our kind of suburban areas of the Twin Cities, and that, you know, those areas tend to be younger in general. They tend to be more affluent. And so we see kind of some areas of the state having a much lower rate of disability than others. Again, recall that overall the state average is about 11%. And the very darkest areas here shown are, you know, 15%+ with a disability. We expect these numbers will continue to grow in the coming years as we continue to age. Many rural counties are beyond the average age, and so they are already well transitioned into an older community, into older communities. But we will see the continuation of disability spread across the state, and particularly in those rural areas. So I want to put a little bit of definition around how disabilities play out in different cultural communities. These numbers come from a report that we did called the Economic Status of Minnesotans. It's on our website, mn.gov/demography, if you're interested in seeing more. But I pulled these numbers on disability to look at Black, Indigenous, people of color, or BIPOC cultural groups that are the largest represented in Minnesota. So I have white non-Hispanic for comparison, but Mexican, US-born African-American, Somali, and Hmong populations are among our largest BIPOC groups here in the state, if we're looking at specific cultural communities. And we see in the case particularly of Hmong Minnesotans and U.S.-born African-Americans, these rates of disability increase, especially after the age of 45. So some of these increases that we see later on for all Minnesotans, we're seeing younger for these communities in particular. So I think it's really striking. I've shared these numbers before with legislative committees, but fully close to one third of people who are US born African American in the ages of 45 to 64 report that they have a disability, as do Hmong Minnesotans, which is much, much higher than the average for that age. In addition to seeing higher rates of disability among BIPOC cultural groups, and some in particular who have been in the U.S. for a very long time, we see lower incomes in general. Based on disability status, about 20% of Minnesotans with a disability have incomes below the federal poverty threshold, which is a little bit more than twice that of people without disabilities. That's something that has remained, as you can see, throughout this series. So it's a pretty steady differential over time. We saw the poverty rate decline a little bit for people after the recession, for all people after the recession, and then kind of level off. And that's been true for people with disabilities and without disabilities. If we look at younger people with disabilities, so now people who are of working age, we can see that a lower proportion of people with disabilities are working. That's in part maybe because they're not able to work certain jobs, or perhaps they're not able to find certain jobs. Perhaps there's discrimination that is keeping them out of the workplace. Any number of reasons would reduce these numbers. But just to give you the general sense of how many people with one of these six disabilities are working, it's about 60%, just under 60%, compared to about 90% for people without disabilities. The other thing I think that stands out is that a much higher proportion of these folks with disabilities are working either part-time or not fully around the whole calendar year. They report working either seasonally or part-time, and that's much more heavily reported among people with disabilities than without disabilities. I'm sharing below this kind of top line number with disabilities, those with different types of disabilities, just for your information. And again, I'm sharing the numbers here just so you have them, but I don't really have anything additional to share other than to give you this general kind of landscape. I will say that the poverty rate that I reported, of course, relates to disability in that people of lower income, lower wealth communities have more health consequences and are much more likely to have disabilities. And then in turn, that's reinforced by differences in work status as well. And then the final kind of point that I wanted to share with you is just how aging is impacting our working age population and what we can expect moving forward, because I think this is one of the most important shifts that we are experiencing as a state, especially as it relates to public budgets and to the provision of services like services for people with disabilities, like healthcare types of services for older adults. Economists sometimes use this measure, the old age dependency ratio, and I think it illustrates well what's happening here. We're looking at the proportion of older adults compared to the proportion or the number of people who are of working age. And we have already begun to see that climb over the last decade, and we will continue to see that climb over the next decade, where it then levels off. And what is driving that, of course, is the number of older adults, as I shared with you at the beginning of this presentation. But at the same time that that is happening, we have basically no growth, little to no growth in the working age population in the state. And so this dependency on those who are working really is being driven by that increase in the older adult population. And the number of people that we have available to work today is going to be very close to the number of people that we have to work here in Minnesota in 10 years, in 15 years, in 20 years. This is something that's really quite easy to project. And that is because we have births in our rear view mirror already. We know how many people have been born and when they will reach working age. We do add a little bit to our projections based on mortality of these folks and based on migration in and out of the state, but that really is at the margin. The main thing that is producing these trends is lower birth rates over generations that have continued to stay low and have lowered even more during the pandemic. So we really do expect very little growth in the workforce, which is concerning given the shortages that many of us are already experiencing, many employers are experiencing, many providers of healthcare services. And this is much more acute in rural areas, as we talked about earlier, where you have smaller working age populations, especially relative to those older adults. Many of our areas around the state, actually, we project to see declines in the coming years in the number of people available to work. And the growth, even though it's slowing in the workforce, is really concentrated mostly in the Twin Cities Metro, where the majority of our growth has been over the last 10 to 20 years. So I'd say that this is particularly an issue for Greater Minnesota, particularly an issue for the provision of healthcare and long-term services and supports where that one-on-one, sometimes in-person support is needed in areas with a small working age population, with people who are dispersed more across the geography and much harder to reach and much more expensive in terms of and expensive in terms of the provision of the service, but also less convenient for people trying to access those services. Right now in the state, of course, we're already experiencing, you all well know this, I'm just sharing it with you to make a final point that we're already experiencing worker shortages. Looking at the demographics that I just shared with you, I really do expect to see those continue and even be exacerbated in some areas because we just don't have the level of the number of people that we would need in order to see this turnaround on its own. There may be changes in migration coming that could always happen, especially if climate change sets up different patterns from what we've been seeing in the US and across the globe. So it's not that it has to play out this way, but if we continue on as we've been continuing with the same levels of migration in and out of the state, with the same levels of migration around the state, we can expect either declines in the number of working age people or same number moving forward. And so with that, I know it's a lot of information, but the time that we are experiencing aging, we've been hearing about it for many, many decades, and it's happening right now, and we really will begin to feel the impact of that aging trend in the coming years, in the short term, as the baby boomers, who are now 58 to 76 years old, continue to move into those older adult years. And I think one of the major challenges that we'll see is providing services and supports given a workforce, a labor force that's really remaining about the same size. And so with that, I will stop my sharing of my slides, and I'm happy to take any questions, Chair Schultz, if there are any.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brower. That was an excellent presentation. And remember, members of the public, the slide deck can be found on our committee website, and members should have been emailed the slide deck, so you have that with you. I think Representative Keel had a question, I believe. Representative Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It kind of got answered in that later discussion, but I was looking at the fact that we have smaller, is it resource? I can't even remember what page that was. It was 13, I think. But services, the ability to provide services in an area that is weak already, that wasn't what I was thinking. So let's pass.
Okay, thank you, Representative Keel. I think based on this information, we have a lot of work to do as legislators. And so it's really insightful to have this information and really concerning. So I think we're really appreciative of having Dr. Brower as our state demographer. And I hope members can contact her and work with her if you have ideas, proposals. So thank you again, Dr. Brower.
Thanks for having me.
I'm not seeing any more questions, so we're going to move on to the next presentation. We have Commissioner Harpstead with us and Deborah Schlick, and they're going to talk about deep poverty, and then we'll have two additional testifiers. So welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Schultz. So I just wanted to start by saying that I was personally deeply moved by the Department of Human Services Deep Poverty Report that was published a year ago in November. I became more clearly aware of how folks in deep poverty who utilize our MFIT program, designed to lift them out of poverty and into solid employment, have to recertify eligibility every month. While we have people who stay on SNAP and housing benefits for 6 months. Also surprised to learn that if we were to sync up those benefits so that they lasted for 6 months, all of them, which counties would love, as this recertification takes a lot of work, we would be the last state in the nation to do so. With so much of today's workforce having jobs whose hours vary every week as people are handed shift schedules, we have people on and off, instead of getting a foothold and moving on, as MFIP and general assistance were intended to do. For those who say, skip MFIP, just get a job, we have a workforce shortage. We do have fewer applicants to these programs when the economy is strong. That is true. And these programs are for people with special barriers to employment. I remember one young woman I met in a listening session last year who just going into COVID found herself divorced with several kids, the house, and unstable child support. She used MFIP to support her family while finishing her bachelor's degree so she could get a job that could sustain her family and keep her off MFIP going forward. That's how it's supposed to work. Deborah Schlick, who's been working in this space for many years in DHS and who taught me all I know about deep poverty, is here with more thorough testimony. And I'll stop here and allow you to hear from our state's expert. Thank you, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Schlick.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and committee members. I've got a slideshow that I'm going to present and share my screen with you. Walk through a package of proposals that the administration is proposing. And I work in the Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division, but the presentation you're going to be seeing really comes across programs and across divisions. And there are online folks who are experts in each of those if you have specific questions that I can't answer. And the roots of this package of proposals, as Commissioner Harkstead has said, come from three places. The first being the analysis that the healthcare division did in a report in 2020 about the impact of deep poverty in the population in Minnesota who receives medical assistance. And also what we know about the income volatility of the Minnesotans who turn to public assistance. And finally, the multi-year effort out of the legislature to simplify public assistance policy and create more uniformity across programs. So those three roots undergird what I'm going to talk about. So since we've referenced deep poverty, we thought we'd give you a little bit of information about what that is. Deep poverty is defined as half income that's half of the poverty line. So the slide here is looking at a single adult. A single adult with income of $536 a month or less is considered in deep poverty. That compares to having income of about $1,000, which would be the poverty line. And those two compare to the turquoise bar, which shows you what the deed cost of living calculator for a very basic needs budget. What does it take for a Minnesotan to pay for housing, pay for transportation, clothing and food, very basic items, which is about $2,700 a month. So you can see that deep poverty is a very tiny fraction of the income it takes to meet basic needs. So, and then similarly for a family of three, deep poverty gets to just above $900 a month. Again, that's half of the poverty line of about $1,800 a month and a fraction of what the deed cost of living calculator shows it takes a household of three to meet their basic needs of $4,900 a month. So this is just to give you a sense of when we use that word deep poverty, what sort of numbers are behind that. The report that Commissioner Harpstead referenced that looked at deep poverty was one of a series of reports that was done that looked at correlations where poor health outcomes were seen and correlated with mental illness, with homelessness, with substance abuse, and with deep poverty. Each was treated separately. What the data showed is that Minnesota adults in deep poverty receiving medical assistance coverage, when compared to other medical assistance recipients, so those are people in poverty or at low income, adults in deep poverty have higher rates of every chronic condition measured in the study, heart disease, diabetes, renal failure, including a mortality rate 2 times higher than adults who are not as poor. Adults in deep poverty receiving medical assistance coverage experienced 40% more preventable emergency department visits and 23% more preventable hospitalizations than those who are not as poor. And children on medical assistance living in deep poverty have a mortality rate that's 2 times higher than other children on medical assistance and experience a higher rate of post-traumatic stress syndrome than children who are not as poor. The other reports that were done in the series looked at what are the evidence-based practices in a healthcare intervention that can help ameliorate the poor health outcomes if someone has a mental illness, if they're homeless, if they have substance abuse disorder. But the researchers hired to look for that evidence for dealing with people in deep poverty find there are almost no medical interventions that change the impact of deep poverty on health. And so what they did was look at what are the evidence-based interventions that get people out of deep poverty and seeing that as a pathway to better health outcomes. And in that report identified that Minnesota's income support programs are an opportunity to more effectively respond to the health impacts of deep poverty that we see in our medical assistance program. And so for the package of proposals I'm going to present, we're talking primarily about two income support programs, the Minnesota Family Investment Program provided to families in financial crisis with children, and general assistance available to adults in some adults in financial crisis without children. So that becomes the link between what we do in our corner of DHS around income support and what the healthcare division's mission is about improving health outcomes. There are two overarching recommendations in that deep poverty report about the overarching opportunities DHS has. One is to look at the programs and policies, redesigning them to more effectively respond to the realities of deep poverty. And those realities include, of course, too little income, but also very volatile income and chronic stress. And secondly, ensure that we do provide resources that carry people through the sort of event that can turn into a crisis, sending a life on the edge over the edge. And those crises can be the birth of a new baby that disrupts employment, the loss of a job, family violence that splits apart families, health events, the other sort of things that create an economic crisis. So as I said, this is one of the roots of the proposal, the package of proposals, is this link between deep poverty and health. What we're proposing for 2022 are initial steps. In and of themselves, they don't move all Minnesotans who are in deep poverty out of deep poverty, but they begin the move in that direction. These five proposals do one of three things or a couple of them. They increase income support to get people closer to being over the deep poverty line. They create more predictability and transparency in the programs. That's key when you think about, again, that link about the stress of the lives of people in deep poverty. So we want to quit being one of the stressors. And they build on that multi-year work to create more uniform programs across public assistance, more uniform policies. The five specific programs, I'm going to list them right now, and then I'll talk about each of them for a couple of minutes so you have some more information. But first of all, we want to increase that general assistance benefit and do so aligning with the Minnesota Family Investment Program benefit structure. Secondly, we want to give people with disabilities who are supposed to be applying for Social Security more realistic timeline to do that. Three, we want to modify the policies we use to fund the Emergency General Assistance Program so that an emergency like the pandemic doesn't disrupt the allocation formula and distort it. Fourth, we want to simplify cash assistance overpayment policies. And then finally, we want to better stabilize income for people who are trying to work their way off cash assistance. So to that first proposal about the general assistance benefit, as I said, general assistance is the income support we offer childless adults who are destitute and unable to work. So about 23,000 people a month receive general assistance, and the amount they receive depends on their circumstances. About 60% receive $203 a month, so more than half the individuals. About 40% receive a lesser amount, a personal needs benefit of $111, but many of them are also receiving help through our housing support program, which pays room and board for seniors and adults with disabilities living on low income. So that $111 is supplemental. And general assistance, it's not enough to be very poor. You have to be very poor, and it has to be shown that you're unable to work to qualify for general assistance. The most common conditions that bring people to general assistance are being disabled and applying for disability income, having a serious medical illness, a serious mental illness, a severe learning disability, or severe developmental disability that prevent work, residing in a treatment facility for a period of time, being older than 55 and determined to be unable to work, or to be assessed by a vocational specialist to be unemployable, or finally to be in a protective or court-ordered services that prevent work. The last time we increased the general assistance benefit for individuals who are both very poor and unable to work was in 1986. So since 1986, that benefit has been $203 a month. If that benefit had been increased to keep up with the same spending power, it would be, this year, it'd be a $502, almost $503 benefit. So it's lost that much spending power since 1986. So the administration is proposing to increase the general assistance benefit to $355 a month. This would be, although it's, you know, it's the first significant increase in 36 years, it doesn't get us to the deep poverty line. It doesn't get us to the spending power, but it certainly takes a major step ahead. And the $355 was chosen because that is what's available to a single person on the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And the way that family program can have a single person is a pregnant woman can come on MFIP and be eligible, or we can have a household where either a parent or a child is disabled, getting their income from federal disability income. So only the non-disabled member is eligible for MFIP. But this would align the cash assistance programs to have the same benefit level for an individual. And it would then incorporate the MFIP's annual cost of living adjustment into the general assistance program so that we don't risk that same stagnation for decades where that benefit doesn't increase its buying power. So just to show you again, this salmon colored bar shows you what the proposed benefit increase would be, $355. It shows what I've already said, not quite up to the deep poverty line, but much closer than we are now, and setting the stage for future improvements. The second proposal in the package is extending the timeline for individuals to apply for Social Security benefits. So when people apply for general assistance or housing support with a disability, they're required to apply for federally funded Social Security benefits within 30 days of submitting their application for the Minnesota program. But this 30-day requirement has turned out in recent years to be impossible to meet for most people, especially those needing an interview with Social Security, where there are significant delays in getting appointments. So our 30-day window doesn't match the reality of the application timeline process at the federal Social Security offices. A 90-day window that we're proposing would be much more realistic. And it also gives people that 90 days, gives them a chance to then connect with agencies that will provide advocacy and support services to help people through what's a very complicated federal process. And moving them off state-funded programs to a federally funded program more quickly. Our third proposal is about simplifying the overpayment policy and cash assistance. What we'd like to do is align with the Child Care Assistance Program policy that was passed last year on Senate initiative. In child care assistance, the individual is not required to pay back an overpayment that results from an error by the county or tribe. The cash assistance policy on county or tribe errors is a little bit different. The individual doesn't have to pay it back if a reasonable person would not have recognized the error. We have determined that that reasonable person standard is unnecessary and creates confusion. Reasons behind that. First, all the benefits are county and tribal eligibility workers work off a state mainframe computer system called Maxis to determine eligibility and issue benefits. That system is programmed so that a household of a particular size, say a family of three, could never in any month get more than the maximum benefit for a household of three. So the error, any error that's going to happen is going to happen with that maximum in place. So it could be a $75 error, it could be a $100 error, a $25 error, but they're not going to ever be able to get double, triple what they're eligible for in a month. So the only way large overpayments accrue is when an error is not discovered for a long time by the county or tribe. So every month, month after month, they're getting $75 more than they should have, for instance. And by the time the county or tribe has discovered it, it's a larger amount. But the fact that the error continued so regularly for so long, by definition, makes it unlikely a reasonable person would have figured out that was an error. We have a DHS, we found that reasonable person standard very difficult to give counties concrete guidance that would result in consistent implementation. So we review any case that a county or tribe believes should be charged for an agency or overpayment. And in those reviews, following standards established for us by the General Counsel's Office, we have not found any cases in which the reasonable person standard has been met. So we would like to just give clearer, more direct guidance to counties and tribes not to count agency error overpayment, not to charge agency error overpayments to the individual, as is done in child care. Our fourth proposal is about emergency general assistance. This is funding available to adult households without children who are in a housing crisis. DHS allocates the funds annually to counties and tribes. The counties and tribes determine how to use that money within some basic parameters. For instance, it can only be households without children. And the allocation formula has always relied on the actual emergency general assistance expenditures from the recent previous years. Well, it became clear during the pandemic that a crisis like the pandemic can really distort that formula. Some counties were spending emergency general assistance money at a faster, higher rate than usual. Others who'd gotten federal money with timelines to spend were setting aside their emergency general assistance till they got the federal money spent. So we're just proposing that we adjust the formula to account for outlier spending during statewide crises that could distort the allocations going forward in more normal times. And then finally, our proposal to address income instability. This is going to be a very high overview. We presented on this in detail last session, so this is more a bit of a reminder about that proposal. We want to stabilize income for households that are trying to work their way off cash assistance. And we want to do that by changing our budgeting methods and by changing the budget periods that are set for people's benefits. This would apply to the Minnesota Family Investment Program and to general assistance. Housing Support already made this change in 2016. And this is a set of policies that are used in the federal SNAP program in Minnesota. So we would align state cash assistance with the federal practices. The volatile income we're speaking about has its roots in the fact that more than half the workers turning to public assistance come from the following industries. They come out of restaurant jobs, retail jobs, low-wage healthcare jobs, and temp agencies. Those industries have very high turnover. They're the industries most likely to have part-time jobs. They're most likely to have hourly shift workers whose shifts are, as Commissioner Harkstead said, constantly fluctuating. So their income, they're either losing income for periods of time, their income is reducing, or their income is increasing, but it's unpredictable to the worker. So in fact, for example, 44% of the families receiving assistance through the Minnesota Family Investment Program experience extreme income instability. And that's defined by having more than a 30% chance that in any one month, they'll either have zero income or twice their average monthly income. And another way we looked at this situation was to pick a six-month period and looked at households that had earnings and saw that they had changes in income in a six-month period. So we're dealing with earned income that's very volatile. And this, as I said, is particularly true that 77% of households with earnings see changes to their earnings, and then they see changes to their benefits. Well, that's only true for a third of the households without earnings. So there are three broad changes we want to make to address them. We want to set benefits for a six-month period instead of a changing period, so that as their earned income goes up and down, they'll know that they can build a household budget around a steady benefit amount in that six-month period. And so then we want to respond to fewer changes in their circumstances during that 6 months, so we'd ask for fewer reports of those changes. And finally, we would use more current income information to determine their benefits. Right now, the program rules have us looking back 2 months to set benefits for a month's period. Or another way for me to say that is, since we're in the month of February, if I were on assistance, the benefits I'd be receiving in February would have been based on my December income. When Housing Support, the Housing Support Program, introduced these changes to their program, they saw the number of participants with earnings increase. And that's the sort of income we're hoping. That's the sort of outcome that has inspired us to introduce that change. That is the presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. That was very informative. We appreciate all you're doing for our state. I'm not seeing any hands, but is it Does it continue to be true that the federal poverty level, the metric itself, which I think was developed in the early 60s, does it continue to be just the cost of food times a factor of three?
Yes, the metric has not changed since the 1960s. There's been a lot of discussion at the federal level about how to make it a more useful metric, but none of those changes have moved forward. So it doesn't take into account, it does take into account of basic goods. It's not very responsive to the increased cost of housing, for instance.
Okay, thank you. So now I see some hands. Representative Noor.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Ms. Schlick, for the presentation. My question is in regards to, you know, a model that is becoming more normal in the Twin Cities and other cities are looking into the guaranteed income program and how that, how does that program, you know, this is more meant for addressing the family poverty at the same time providing economic security for families compared to what we're doing at the state. I know their income, we're giving them if they're receiving public assistance from one side and then we're taking it away from the other side. Is there a fix to a program like that at the state level?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Noor, there are some places in the state running what they call guaranteed income pilots. The fix would be if the state legislature for that pilot period wanted public assistance programs not to count the income provided through those pilots. If your question is specific to the interaction between those pilots and our public assistance programs, our proposals don't change the fundamental nature of public assistance programs, which is that they tightly and clearly define who is eligible and who is not eligible for that public assistance. But this would smooth out the volatility that families and individuals receiving that assistance experience in our current programs.
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, so is it just fair that if I assume this small guaranteed income that families are receiving will be treated as an earned income and it's going to reduce their benefit a dollar for a dollar?
Ms. Schlick?
Chair Schultz and Representative Noor, we would treat it as unearned income and the effect would be exactly what you described. It would reduce their benefit dollar for dollar. Earned income in the Minnesota Family Investment Program and General Assistance, earned income, we don't count fully dollar for dollar. When the state designed the programs, they wanted there to be a work incentive. So it's a less than dollar by dollar offset.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. It's something that we need to look into. We don't want to be giving from one perspective from a local government and then we're taking it away from the other programs at the state level. So I look forward to working with Representative Pinto on his bill and make it more open for some of the cities who are applying the program right now. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Noor. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I just want to respond, and I see that Chair Pinto has his hand up, but he indeed had a bill to do just that in the last, well, he has a bill, and it was part of our omnibus bill, and we worked very, very hard to try to get that through exactly what you're talking about, Representative Noor, and we were unable to get the Senate to agree to it. So that's, we recognize the problem fully. You're absolutely right. And Chair Pinto, I see he put his hand down. I think I probably said what he was about to say. But the reason that I raised my hand twofold, first of all, Commissioner and Ms. Schlick, thank you so much for that presentation. It's chilling to think about what we do to our families and our people who are in poverty. And it's almost impossible to conceive of how a person lives on such small amounts of money and how they get by and how stressful it is and all of those things. You know, I think we just need to do better. And of course, the presentation that Representative Schultz brought us from the demographer that preceded your presentation, it's all very, very clear. We have a flatlining workforce, and we really need to make sure that every single person who can has the opportunity to be in the workforce. And we are not helping that goal with the way we do our poverty program right now. And we did take a run at this also in our omnibus bill. We were unsuccessful, but I hope we can tee it up. We have money to do it. You know, it does cost some money because it means that more people stay on the program. They're not flipping on and off. But wow, what a worthy goal. And we haven't even talked about the impact on the kids or in those families who are in deep poverty, because we know that poverty itself is an incredible risk factor for children. So there's just many, many, many reasons to target our resources in that way. I did want to just ask a couple things or make a couple more specific comments. One is that I'd love to see the graph. Ms. Schlick showed a really great, or maybe it was a commissioner, showed the graph of, you know, where families are, what the levels are for deep poverty and so on. And I'd like to see that same graph with the MFIT benefit in there, because my understanding is that even with our MFIT benefit, people are still below the line, and we increased the benefits and we linked it now to inflation for MFIP at least. And we do absolutely need to do the same thing for general assistance. So I just would love to see that at some point. The other thing, I just had a comment or a concern about the overpayments issue. I totally understand what you mean about the reasonable person standard and fixing that and all, but I do have a little concern that, you know, once in a while you read in the paper that there's some big computer glitch and somebody gets a check with an extra zero or an extra two zeros in it. And I just hope that as we make this change, that it can be one where we don't give away the right to recollect something like that. That's just ridiculously out of bounds. I just hate to see that court case where the state has said that we can't recollect it if it's, you know, multiples of what it should have been. So that's just, you don't even have to respond to that now, but I just really wanted to say how much I appreciated that presentation and look forward to continuing work on that whole topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, for those questions and comments. And I also believe you're working on legislation to address the spend down thresholds to get eligible for some of our public programs like medical assistance. So we really appreciate work you're doing in that space as well. Other questions from members or comments? Not seeing any. So again, members, we have a lot of work to do. We should definitely be looking more broadly, not just at deep poverty and poverty, but those who cannot cover their basic needs, because that federal poverty index is not very meaningful anymore. And we have a large percentage of the population in Minnesota that don't have enough income to cover their basic needs. And I hope that we can all get behind these proposals that DHS is bringing us to make sure families, children have more income stability and can get back on their feet and work, since we need people in our workforce with our severe workforce crisis that we face in Minnesota. So thanks again to our presenters today. We are going to be meeting next on Thursday, and we are going to have a presentation of the governor's supplemental budget. So hopefully you can all join us on Thursday to get that overview, and we should have plenty of time for questions. So with that, members, we are adjourned. Have a great day, everyone.